Imagine. It's the year 1560 in Ferrara, Italy. You're 16 years old, newly married to one of the richest, most powerful men in the country. And today, you're standing before him and the artist who is about to paint your portrait. Your name is Lucrezia de' Medici.
Could I trouble Her Highness to please lift her chin a little? More? A touch more? Good. Beautiful. Now turn your face towards the window, slowly, please. Slowly. Yes, there. Hold that, Your Highness. Then, without turning his head, he addresses someone behind him. Do you see, Your Grace? I feel this may be better than the previous pose. We get the curve of her jaw, the elegance of her neck. Although how I will ever find a paint to reproduce that flush along her throat and that brow. Alfonso, clothed in dark colours today, moves about in the shadowy recesses of the room. He is examining sketches arranged on a low table. For several hours now, Lucrezia has been asked to pose in one way, seated, standing, feet crossed, hands laced, hands apart, head forward, head aside, arm up, arm down, wrist turned, while the artist makes a sketch. He then repositions her and does another. Lucrezia finds the situation ludicrous. The idea that Alfonso is permitting another man to touch her dress or her hand or her jewels is so peculiar. If this man weren't painting her, it would not be out of the realm of possibility for Alfonso to unsheath the dagger he keeps in his belt and run him through. She has heard of men killed for less.
Irish novelist Maggie O'Farrell is known for bringing lost historical figures to life. Her best-selling novel, Hamnet, recreated Shakespeare's family life. And in her latest, The Marriage Portrait, she tells us the story behind a real painting, a 16th century Renaissance portrait of a young noblewoman. O'Farrell told Shannon Henry Kleiber she came across a reference to it first in a poem, wondered what the painting looked like, and who the young woman was.
So I started looking it up, I started delving around, and it wasn't long before I had her name, Lucrezia de' Medici, and the really sad fact that she'd been 16 when she died. Mm-hmm. And then this portrait, which is attributed to Anilo Bronzino, was downloading on my very old phone screen. And, you know, I could see this kind of jeweled headdress, and then I saw this very pale brow, and then these very large, slightly startled-looking brown eyes. She looks quite anxious. She's wearing this very dark dress against a black background with a white collar, and she's adorned with jewellery, which I later found out is half from her father's dynasty and half from her husband Tavi's dynasty. But as soon as I saw her, it was a kind of lightning bolt. I mean, I knew as soon as I looked into her eyes that I was going to write a novel about her, that I was looking at the subject of my next book.
Wow. What is it about portraits that's so revealing? I mean, you were so pulled in through her eyes, and who would be the subject of a portrait in those times?
Well, in those times, I mean, it varied. I think in order to have your portrait painted in 16th century in what we now call Italy, we're talking about Italy before Italy existed, in a sense. It was made up of a kind of jigsaw of city-states governed by men like Lucrezia's father, who was Cosimo de' Medici, Grand Duke of Tuscany, and her husband, who was Alfonso d'Este, Duke of Ferrara. But the kind of wealth that men like Cosimo and Alfonso had is absolutely jaw-dropping. I mean, Lucrezia's dowry was 200 gold scudi. I had no idea what that meant, so I asked a fiscal historian. Yeah, well, apparently it's the equivalent of $50 million in today's money. I mean, Cosimo was unbelievably wealthy, so he was able to commission portraits of all his family, of himself, of his wife. He and his wife, Eleonora di Toledo, had pretty much an arranged marriage, as Lucrezia's was. But they, I think really unusually for their class and time, they really loved each other. They adored each other.
Wow.
So, and he, that one of my favorite portraits of her, because in the most expensive color in those days was blue, because it was made from powdered lapis lazuli. But there's one portrait of Eleonora, the background, which is normally landscapes, it's just blue. There's so much blue. And I just have this kind of vision of Cosimo saying, I want more lapis, more of it. I want everyone to know how gorgeous my wife is and how lovely she looks and how rich we are.
So it's really to tell people about your status.
Yeah, it was also status, but I think it was about betrothal.
Yes.
You didn't necessarily see your future wife-to-be or your husband-to-be. So you would be sent literally an oil painting.
It's like what a dating site would be now, but yeah, in those days.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of marriages were arranged like that. Henry VIII apparently was very disappointed. He'd seen, I forget now which of his wives was it, he'd seen a painting of her and he'd approved and said, yes, okay, I'll marry her. And then when she actually arrived, he realised that the painter had been kind, shall we say. And he was apparently not very pleased with the in real life version. So I think it was problematic because I think as the artist, you'd want to be paid and you wouldn't want to do a warts and all portrait. But at the same time, there's an awful lot riding on these portraits, you know, these kind of betrothal portraits in a sense.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting about marriage itself, too. If you're looking from the outside at someone's marriage, it's so complicated and depending on how you're viewing it. And do you think of that as part of how you were creating this story, that a marriage is a complicated thing?
Absolutely. I felt very sorry for Lucrezia for a lot of reasons, actually, because she was married to Alfonso, who by many accounts was very cold and pretty heartless. I think really all he was looking for was basically just a womb that was going to produce lots of heirs for him and for his region. He was married to Lucrezia for a year before she died, possibly murdered by him, possibly not. There was a rumour that he did murder her, but the autopsy when she died said that she died of natural causes. I should mention that the autopsy was performed by Alfonso's court doctor, so a man in his pay. When she died, Cosimo and Eleonora sent their court physician from Florence to attend the autopsy, but it was performed before they arrived. She was already buried. Mm-hmm. So make of that what you will.
So the marriage portrait was created before she was married.
Yeah, so the only portrait we have of Lucrezia is one that was commissioned by the Medicis just before she began her married life at the age of 15. One of the many questions that arose from me seeing that is that the other siblings, and as I mentioned, her parents, were painted numerous times in numerous iterations and positions. But Lucrezia was only painted once in this one portrait. Mm. And even sadder than that, as I said, there is a room in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence dedicated to the branch of the Medicis that were Lucrezia's family. But she's not there. The rest of them are there, but I spent a long time, actually, when I went to Florence, trying to track down this portrait, the original of the portrait that I had seen on the internet. And I know that it was somewhere in the Uffizi Gallery. So I spent a long time trying to track it down in Florence because I couldn't work out where it was. And I had three art historians in Florence who were helping me and they couldn't find it either. We were really baffled. Mm. And eventually one of them said, I think it's in the Palazzo Pitti. So I went there and I had a printout of the portrait. And I was showing all the guards. I said, can you tell me where this portrait is? And they all said, no, I've never seen it before. It's not here. You've made a mistake. I don't know where it is. So I spent ages, about hours walking around. And eventually I found it. And it's in this very, very small, quite distant, very crowded room. I mean, crowded with portraits. And it's low down on the wall next to a fire extinguisher. And there she is. Oh. And it's about the size of a hardback book. And that really broke my heart. I thought, why is she over here on her own? Why isn't she with the rest of her family? Mm-hmm. And why is she in such an ignominious position? She ought to be in the main Uffizi. She ought to be in that room with her family.
She deserved her story to be told by you.
Yes, exactly. It just maybe, well, I just, from all kind of sources or all accounts, I just always got the impression, it was impossible not to get the impression that Lucrezia was overlooked and underloved. You know, I often think, a lot of portraits of the type, young girls in the Renaissance, you know, a lot of them look very kind of meek and expressionless, almost blank. It was the style, I think. But Lucrezia looks really troubled. She looks worried. She looks anxious. And crucially for me, she looks as if she has something she wants to say.
Mm-hmm. And you are painting a portrait in the marriage portrait. I mean, you are doing that.
Yes. there's a kind of motif that runs through the novel, a symbol, I suppose you'd call it, where as I was researching it, I read about, you know, the sort of techniques that Renaissance artists used. A lot of these artists were actually very poor. They lived from hand to mouth. So a lot of them actually painted over old canvases or old work or old tableaux. So, and that really thrilled me, that idea, the idea that you might go to a gallery and there are these incredibly famous paintings, but there might be another painting behind them. But we don't know that, because who would take a who would take turpentine to Birth of Venus, you know? But the idea that it's possible, you know, it's people have x-rayed the Mona Lisa and have seen that Da Vinci tried out different iterations of her smile before settling on the last one. And to me, that feeds a lot into the knowledge. You know, I wanted the idea of the underpainting, other narratives hiding in the shadows behind the one that we think we know.
Hmm. I love the idea of the underpainting that's through your book. And you did that, delving deeper into these layers. What was going on in your life when you were working on this book?
Probably suffice to say that I had the idea first in February 2020. So I probably don't even need to say what ensued. So I wrote this book pretty much. It was bookended by the pandemic and by lockdown. And essentially, actually, Lucrezia and her brothers and sisters lived in lockdown their whole lives. Mm. You know, to be the daughter of an incredibly powerful ruler like Cosimo, to be born into that dynasty. Obviously, she was born into a life of enormous, enormous privilege. But at the same time, it was too dangerous for Lucrezia and her brothers and sisters, because they were the very, very precious heirs to the Medici throne. They could be kidnapped, they could be assassinated. So they were kept indoors pretty much all their life. As children, they lived in two rooms up on the fourth floor of the palazzo. And if they wanted exercise, they would walk around the battlements. And that was it.
And so you related as you were during the pandemic.
Well, I suppose I only thought about it really afterwards. But yeah, I don't think it's a coincidence that I was writing about a life of confinement.
How do you think modern day portraiture, photography, Instagram can show things in a different way from that portraiture? Or how is it the same? I mean, I look back at these gorgeous layers of paint and think that stands forever. And then these kind of fleeting Instagram things that can be deleted, but maybe they are forever too. I mean, our online persona can be forever.
That's true. Yeah. I will say that to my kids as a warning. I think in a lot of ways, it's pretty much the same. You know, obviously the world changes all the time. The world of Lucrezia living in the Palazzo Vecchio is completely gone. Our world would be utterly alien to her. But I think at the same time, human hearts and minds and brains haven't really changed that much at all. And when people are posting pictures on Instagram, they want to wear the nicest clothes and their best jewellery and their makeup, and they want their hair to look good, just as the Renaissance people did when they were getting ready for their portrait. They were thinking about what cloth flattered them the most. They were thinking about jewellery, how to wear their hair, you know, how to stand. Did they want to lean on books to look clever? Did they want to have their region behind them to say, check out how powerful I am? You know, it's actually just the same, isn't it?
So interesting. Maggie, this is great. I just so enjoy reading your books. Beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was novelist Maggie O'Farrell, author of The Marriage Portrait. She talked with Shannon Henry Kleiber from her home in Edinburgh. Why does the portrait figure so prominently in the history of art?
Most of the paintings he made, like the big ones, they hung them on the walls and they kind of look like wall paintings. Very big civic guards.
Where do I go for the hall's rooms?
Yes, so take his door and then all the way follow just the rooms.
Coming up, we travel to the Frans Hals Museum in the Netherlands, looking to uncover the secrets of one of Europe's greatest portrait painters. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.